This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our program features poets reading their work and talking about their craft. Our poet today is the Poet Laureate of West Virginia, Mark Harshman, and he's going to be here with an opening poem. He's come all the way from Wheeling, and here he is.
This is a poem called Diving for the Drowned. It's my memorial poem for James Wright. Anyone who lives in the Upper Ohio Valley, as I do in Wheeling, West Virginia, is haunted by the presence of Wright and his poetry over all the work that we might happen to do. In this particular poem, I reference some place names in his hometown of Martins Ferry, Ohio. I also, at one point in the poem, refer to the way an airplane years ago would, a little propeller plane might soar over a city trailing little placards of letters for advertising or electioneering purposes, and that comes into the poem. So I would have you know that. I would also remind you that the Ohio River is its own kind of presence, and I think it haunted Wright. He frequently refers with great admiration to the men it would have been in his generation who had to go out into the river and rescue those who had drowned. I guess not rescue, but bring up those who had drowned, including the suicides. Diving for the drowned. Off the river and up the hill into Ferry. My first time beyond the four-lane to downtown. Brick and glass, the Five Roses, Deluxe Novelty, Dutch Henry's, the turreted bank, the strung stoplight centering town, and overhead, an airplane trailing its letters, Bob Sumner, county clerk. A good day to advertise, a dark, shingled sky, only here and there licked white with the race clouds of the cold front. A good background for words, the letters only occasionally tipping out of sight. A good background, the valley direct and unmistakably Appalachian. The crowded squeeze of houses between hill and river, between factory and rock, coal and smoke, the kind of place you want to leave and somehow never do. Small towns like this hold on forever, their close blanket of sweat, their tight rooms of cigarettes and cold where you fight to sleep, their everybody knows you faces flashing everywhere you turn on the brick-rumpled streets. But there were heroes, ones who knew something, who knew the underriver and found the lost. The river's stink, a pale skin of rot upon them, the ones who came back living, rising with stories from that dive into the green, silver, and silent current, who had reached into that liquid night and rose, having touched death with life, yet having brought no answers, but the persistent one that lives with the telling, the return of words that keep us close, next to each other.
Fabulous. The voice of Mark Harshman. And if you all heard that line, green, silver, and silent rivers, the title of his book, a collection of 30 years of writing, is Green, Silver, and Silent. And this is who he is. He's the Poet Laureate of West Virginia, as we said, the award-winning author of poetry chapbooks and children's picture books. I think I counted some 11, and that's where I first met him. He's received the West Virginia Arts Commission Fellowship in Poetry and also Children's Literature. He's been an instructor at the Historic Appalachian Writers Workshop Hindman Settlement School in Hindman, Kentucky. Born in Indiana, Mark has spent most of his life in West Virginia, and it is such a pleasure to have him. He writes of the land. Other than that, how do you describe this book?
Well, as you say, Grace, it does represent over 30 years of my writing as a poet. And so it's clear the landscape and the land itself figure a lot into my work. I guess I can never, there'll never be any way to deny the fact that I was raised on a farm until I was a teenage boy and surrounded all that growing up period by farm life. And it's important to me in ways I don't think even yet I've come quite to fully acknowledge nor realize, but I know it's there. I know when I think of people who have been inspiring to me, I always think of someone like Wendell Berry, where the land and its the husbandry necessary to properly care for the land is so important to him, and it's important to me.
And what I love the most is that you know the name of every bird and every flower and every rusty fence there is. And you're like a novelist in that respect, the one who must know detail. And this is what gives it the tone. This is, I think, if anything I had to say that made it significant, it is the particularity of nature. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yes. I'm in love. I'm obsessed with names.
So you couldn't live in Washington?
Oh, I might be able to because I'm always forgetting things. And it was just lovely walking around here yesterday and seeing that all the trees had little name tags on them. So I don't get that in the wilderness.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to have you. Mark Harshman, let's hear another poem.
Sure, sure. Thinking of the country, we're in West Virginia, throughout Appalachia and probably throughout any rural area in the world, there's an impulse to not let anything go to waste. And so men and women will often take to the woods and be scavenging things or salvaging something from an old deserted farmstead. And that figures into this next poem I'm going to read called A Winter of Sweets. It's based on a true story. And I don't think I need to give you anything other than that, except that as I sit here, I can still close my eyes and see my home on Sally's Backbone in Marshall County and hear an old friend telling me this story about how he and his friend went out to this beyond the beyond forgotten farmstead and they were looking for, well, you'll find out, a winter of sweets. Far below the hayfield, in a grove of post locusts, Jim Gorby, exploring an abandoned house that had stood below the old Miller place, was ready to believe in ghosts when Jerry Briggs, home from the war, stopped hammering on a sheet of tin he was hoping to salvage and revealed an infernal roaring deep within the old clabberds, as if 1,000 restless spirits were clamoring to be let out. And as his eyes adjusted to the lamplight, he witnessed a long wall pulsing and wavering with sound. The trembling transferred itself quickly to Jim, who, white-faced, began easing himself from the room. But Jerry had heard of this before and knew, and a day later, in better light and cautiously with smoke, began unpeeling the century-old poplar siding, lath and mortar dusting the toes of his boots, and there, beneath the thumb of his crowbar, found a giant's hive of clover and locust honey, a marvel to see and, as he was like to say years later, promising a winter of sweets.
We're at the Library of Congress with Mark Harshman. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Now I know, Mark, you need to make a CD of your poems. Other than this 30 minutes, you need to make a CD of your poetry. And do you know why? I have read those poems. I got a whole other dimension. And do you know if anyone wants to know how to read a poem? Punch those vowels. You got the secret. You really ride those vowels. Did you know it, Mark?
No. It is one of the blessings of being able to do the kind of work that I have wanted to do all my life is that I feel remarkably and blessedly free when I come to my work to read it, because the gathering of these words is a part of who I am. And so I suppose it makes the reading of the poems, obviously for you, Grace, thank you, it must make them work.
But you dissolve. There's nothing about you in it. You step back and you let the poem take on three dimensions and you create this visual for us, which I haven't heard read like that in a very long time. So do it again.
All right.
Mark Harshman.
A very different poem then. Thinking of that last one, one of the characters there is based on a lot of truth. And in this poem called These, it's one man's sort of recollected conversation, both real conversation and imagined conversation, with another friend who's come back from one of these wars in the desert lands that have been happening the last couple of decades. And it's an imagined conversation. I would have the listener have in mind the notion of dog tags as I read this, although they're not referenced. These. for Jerry. These are not lucky charms. These are bits of bone and sinew. Home from the war, he pressed them into my hand. I said, thanks, and he walked away. Far away he had been. Steep valleys, hot mountains of war, highs stolen when the moon was bright and the enemy shy. See, he once said on leave, there won't be much left of me. I know that now, holding his hand in mine. Charms are not enough. Prayer names names. We try them, one after another. Repeat after each, Lord, have mercy, Lord, Lord. Names have memories. I wear his now. Pray them as if he hears.
And while we're getting a good sample of you, let's continue.
All right. This is a little poem written on Sally's backbone. I remember that clearly, although it's primarily just about a bird, and you had said I knew the names of birds. Thank my fourth grade teacher, Mrs. Everett, who taught us all the birds, wonderful lady.
Mrs. Everett, let's say her name.
Mrs. Everett.
She'll never die now.
That's right, she won't, bless her heart. In fact, she not only taught me, she taught the leaves in the autumn, and she taught us the birds in the spring. And my father, who was a very busy man at this time in my life, probably in the factory and on the farm, he became obsessed with it too. So every weekend and even some evenings, we would drive out to an abandoned gravel pit so I could see cranes, which is what we call a great blue heron and little green herons. We would go out to another a little branch of the Mississinewa River so that I could see indigo buntings fly along and things like this. And I didn't do that. I mean, I love my father dearly now that he's gone even more. And yet, those are special times. And thanks to Mrs. Everett. Here we go. It's called Junco. Junco, and it's got a great epigraph. Seen with the eye of contemplation, creatures are vestiges, the very footprints of God. So says St. Bonaventure. Junco. A gray bird in a red bush, an empty stream of stones and brittle leaves, a chittering song sung, then followed by a silence that lifts up the sky, lifts the sky with an echoing that fills the world as if the world were no bigger than this room, and this room, porous with mystery and now shot with light, becomes the place within which I might walk forever out of time, along a dry stream bed, behind the chittering of a bird. This bird who, no bigger than the palm of my hand, seems to know the way better than I.
What a holy poem. That is a holy poem, a reverent one. The only place I ever saw a pileated woodpecker was when I lived in West Virginia, and I haven't seen one since. Do you see a lot of them?
I have some that live in the back in the woods behind our house, right in Wheeling.
Show off.
Jonathan Williams has a great poem for a pileated woodpecker. Can I recite it?
Do you know it by heart?
Yes.
Go ahead.
A pileated woodpecker's response to four dogwood berries. Cuck. Cuck, cuck. Cuck, 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 cuck. Cuck, 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 cuck.
Mark Harshman doing bird songs.
Yes, doing bird songs. This is what my career has come to.
It's come to quite a bit. Actually, tell me the story of how you were told you were the poet laureate of West Virginia.
Oh, yes, that. I was in a little school, gosh, I forget exactly where, but down the river, and I was teaching a group of children a little writing workshop, and my cell phone goes off. And I was embarrassed because I usually don't have it with me, and even more rare do I have it turned on. But it was on. It made that horrible sound. I click it off. I go back to teaching. An hour later, I'm flying down the interstate further into the mountains. I have another school I'm going to go visit. And I think, oh, I should call this number back. So I open up the keypad. I punch in the number. And here's the governor's office. Some very young one asking me if I would like to be the next poet laureate of West Virginia. And the stuttering and stammering that went on should have disqualified me immediately because it was the last thing I was expecting to hear.
They let the receptionist call you?
I don't know that she was the receptionist, but she certainly was not the governor, nor anyone
and
particularly.
And tell me, Mark, what was your answer?
Well,
No, I don't think so.
Eventually, it was yes. I did actually ask them whether they thought they had the right person.
They thought you had. You say this is my daughter's cell phone.
That's right. Yes, sir.
And what does it entail?
Well, I don't think it's not. It's a great honor, and I'm very humbled. What it entails is not particularly spelled out. I know for myself, I have a great hope that I can do everything I can to support not only writers, frankly, but artists of all stripes throughout the state of West Virginia, as long as I'm the laureate, to bring their work into the limelight any way I can, to encourage younger writers and authors, not only young ones, which I do continually through my work as a children's author, but also, you know, young adults, you know, people in their 20s and 30s that are thinking about a career as a writer. And I hope that I can say a good word to them and for them both.
Right. Well, let us talk a moment about this great gala you're putting on for the former poet laureate, who I knew very well. And it's a lifetime appointment, isn't it?
That seems to be a question I don't know how to answer.
Well, we'll see.
But the last two poet laureates, Irene McKinney and before her Louise McNeil, once they were appointed, they served until their deaths.
So,
and in fact, when Irene passed away in February of 2012, I knew full well that they would be seeking another poet laureate. I never dreamed, however, that it would be me.
Tell us a little bit more about Irene McKinney and give us a poem.
She was a wonderful, wonderful woman about whom I cannot say enough, a brilliant poet and a deeply caring individual, someone who truly did support other writers throughout the state of West Virginia, had infinite reserves of kindness. And she was also, however, a true West Virginian in a way I don't know quite how to say, other than that she was gutsy and feisty and was not afraid to speak her own mind.
That's true. Mm-hmm. Let's have a poem of hers.
This is a small poem of Irene's, but I like it, I think, in part because I hear her voice in this poem so much. It's from her book, Vivid Companion, from WVU Press. Personal. None of this is personal, not the way you'd think. The moon keeps on traveling, and I can see it from my balcony each night, and each night different. But it's not my own. Not like we want things to be our very own. But it sways me, nevertheless, and stands in for certain losses and gains. And for even that much, I'm grateful. I stand at the back door and stare.
I visited her at her college and recorded her. Was it Westminster?
West Virginia Wesleyan.
West Virginia Wesleyan. Let's have some more poetry by Mark Harshman.
Yes, this was a poem. This is one of the things that happened. You would think it was one of my responsibilities, and I think I saw it as that. But it only happened because I happened to be laureate during the 150th anniversary of our state. And because of that, the Wheeling National Heritage Area, a wonderful group of folks there in Wheeling, commissioned me to write a sesquicentennial poem. And this is a part of that poem. And it begins, the reason I thought of it, it begins with an epigraph from one of Irene's poems. And so I'll read the first couple of stanzas. And it's a kind of survey poem in the sense of Walt Whitman, and then I'll jump to the last couple of stanzas. A song for West Virginia. We give the mountains our names, and they stand still. Irene McKinney. Mountains called Nathaniel, Cole, Cheat, Blair. Rivers called Potomac, Kanawha, Greenbrier, New, Elk, Ohio. Remembered places, Droop, Greenbank, Arthurdale, Blennerhassett, Matewan. Beauty and tragedy, heroism and courage, stitch the patches of our history's quilt. These are not easy times, nor were theirs. 1863, not easy. Western Virginia families split by war. How speak ease with typhus? Women and children outnumbering men, growing deathless of the young, lost at Antietam, Cloyd's Mountain, Winchester. Nor are ours easy. Jim and his chinos panhandling the crossroads, families at the dump, weather channel wailing, Mother Nature mainlining, new diseases spawning. But our forebears knew to dream and begin again. A cloud of witnesses watching even now, for there are frail forms fainting still at our cabin doors. Forgotten and remembered names, let our fingers trace their scars on the skin of who we might yet be. Listen again, the old tunes, the long ago mornings, the lost ones. Listen to Wilson Douglas, Phoebe Parsons, Harvey Sampson, whose fiddle leads us through those yew piney mountains. Scrape and trill, drone and run like a river through the mountain's heart. 150 years and hundreds more to come. Think of it. Take up the patterns of those who've given us their lives. Take up the patches of this history quilt, this dream-flagged quilt. Wave it high and walk proud. These crumpled folds and crags of mountain and valley, these green rolling hills, and let no man haul it away. No coward with a bankroll buy us out. No circus fast talkers take what ours. And what a dream, still ours, still new, just beginning. Again that bell, again those trumpets, fiddles, drums, hands together, how sweet the sound. Let us clap, let us sing. And though we know, President Kennedy, that the sun indeed does not always shine here in West Virginia, you were right. These, our people, always do and always will. West Virginia, you are my home, our home. Forever may you sing, and forever may you shine.
The voice of Mark Harshman, an act of heroism. At our cabin doors, that line is just perfect. At our cabin, all of this majestic work, still we can't forget the cabin door. You know, every poet laureate needs to have a bicentennial poem on hand. You know, Joseph Brodsky told me that everyone needs to have a Nobel Prize speech acceptance ready because it takes too long to write. How long did it take you?
Oh, it took me
six months?
Yes, it did. I got the commission sometime last winter, and I just immediately went and immersed myself in West Virginia history and culture for several months, and then I began writing several poems. I must have had four, five, six different poems on my desk going at one point. And this was the last poem I wanted, in a sense, because I had talked with the commission, and we had thought it might be nice to really make a nice keepsake broadside of the poem. And I was thinking of a single sheet. And this one just got out of hand, became this long Whitman-esque 8 to 10 pages of poem.
It is Whitman-esque.
Nonetheless, bless the commission's heart, they went ahead and did a nice keepsake anyway.
How I miss the ambitious poem, because today's poets don't take the time.
There's a wonderful article in the current Hudson Review just about the poem of the occasion, as it used to be called.
Occasional poetry.
Yes,
right.
Yes,
but that's but to do that and to make it something that will last forever. And now we know the names of every river as well as the leaves and the birds.
Oh, no. I left out several. I wish I could have got them all in. But yes, we've got several there. You're right.
Before we go to a couple of final poems, I knew you first and bought your books, by the way, when I think it was 20 years ago, Mark. We were at a book fair, and I knew you first as a children's author. So for everyone who's listening, and none of us knows this, tell us, if you can briefly, what you do when you get the start of an idea, what triggers it, what do you do first, how do you proceed, how do you make a children's book, or is each one different?
Well, I suppose in one sense, each is different. What I often tell the children is that my children's books, and I think all my work, frankly, comes from three major sources. Some of the books come simply from real life, taking something that's really happened to me and reinventing it, or sometimes even just telling the story. Sometimes we get lucky. There was a blizzard that occurred about 1960 when I was 10 years old, and all these people got stranded near our country house, and they came knocking at our door. and asking if they could come inside. My mother said, sure, and they came in, and the house fills up. My mother puts on a big pot of chili, and eventually they're all sitting down at our table. And you can imagine, on the farm in 1960, this is a big event to have all these strangers there sitting at our table. My daddy couldn't get home, so that made it even more different and strange. And of course, as I tell kids, if you're ever around grown-ups and you mention snowstorms or blizzards, everybody has a story to tell. And that's how the story, and it's called, the book's called Snow Company, and it's simply about that evening. Eventually, they have to spend the night. And as a little boy, I was just thrilled. It was great. I think I end the book by saying, and I hope that everybody will have their own story to tell the next time company comes. Some stories come from real life. Some come from taking an old story and retelling it in a new way. I love to do that. My third book, and probably easily my most popular children's book in Appalachia, was called Rocks in My Pockets. And it comes from my listening to the storytelling of Bonnie Collins, a Vandalia Award winner for her contribution to traditional arts and crafts in West Virginia. She passed away just a couple of years ago in her mid-90s, and she had told stories all her life, a real treasure. And she had once told me this story, and I took it and adapted it and became Rocks in My Pockets. So you take an old story and retell it. And I tell the children, they know how to do that. They remember their fairy tales, their folk tales. They can take that story and retell it. So retellings, real life. And the third source of my stories, that impossible place to describe, the imagination, that place where we dream.
You know, you have something that Ted Kooser has, much which Ted Kooser has, I must say. If I could compare any poet whose work is sunny like yours. Mm. He said he has had a great handicap of having a happy childhood for a poet. And I would say you have that problem. Let us have a final poem.
All right. This is a poem called Done with Lying and Bad Luck. I use the word scythe here. Scythe, if you can hear the TH, I mean that cutting bar instrument. And it's a mother grieving her lost son, done with lying and bad luck. If I could tell you the stars knew that they were for you, could say they were cool fires that would come to you, gather at the mast of your days a single enduring sun. If I could tell you the crickets here wanted to share with you their simple meal, the green, the dew, a piece of wind, that they had the road to all our dead open through the tangled wonder of this garden. If I could give you their dictionary, their scores, their fiddling beds. If I could give you room larger than the night, a dull sigh of moon done with lying and bad luck. If I could bow you the old songs in the corner there beside the fire, the long-ago mornings, the lost ones, the old ones, your mother's hands leading you up in the dark mornings, her hand, yours, ready for the sun. If I could, if I could.
That is the voice of Mark Harshman, The Tangled Wonder of This Garden. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry, with additional support by the Reva and David Logan Foundation. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.